I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the June 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Terry Blaine highlights the historic career of composer Florence Price. "I have two handicaps, those of sex and race. I am a woman, and I have some Negro blood in my veins." Florence Price's assessment of her standing as a classical composer was all too accurate. Born in 1887 in Little Rock, Arkansas, into a mixed-race family of African-American descent, she spent much of her professional life grappling with what one writer has called the dangerous mélange of segregation, Jim Crow laws, entrenched racism and sexism in post-Civil War American society. Price's family circumstances were, however, better than those of most other African Americans. Her father was a successful dentist, at a period when the number of black dentists in the entire U.S. barely reached double figures. Her mother was a pianist and music teacher, and the family lived in a generously appointed home with its own reading room, a grand piano, and elegant furniture. By the age of 4, Florence had played her first piano recital, and by 11, her first composition was published. Hers was, by any standards, a comfortable, privileged childhood. And yet, the racist wolf continued to maraud in society at large. To avoid it, Price's mother took special measures when Florence went to study organ and piano at the New England Conservatory in Boston. "My grandmother didn't want my mother to be a Negro," one of Price's daughters later commented. "So, when she took her to Boston, she rented an expensive apartment with a maid and forced my mother to say her birthplace was not Little Rock, but Mexico." Price flourished at college, and although she taught successfully after graduating in 1906 and had more pieces published, the path ahead was often rocky. For a time after divorcing her abusive first husband, Thomas, in 1931, she worked as a cinema organist and wrote radio jingles to support two children as a single mother. Her breakthrough finally came 2 years later in 1933 when her Symphony No. 1 in E minor was premiered by the prestigious Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the first symphony by a black woman to be performed by a major American orchestra. Price had completed the work a year earlier when it won the $500 first prize in a competition sponsored by the National Association for Negro Musicians. The concert at the Auditorium Theater on 15th of June was part of the Century of Progress exposition at the Chicago World's Fair and was billed "The Negro in Music." Price's symphony shared the program with works by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, Harry T. Burley, Roland Hayes, and, bizarrely, John Powell, who held white supremacist views. Price's symphony drew growing accolades from the critics, one of whom experienced a feeling of awe at witnessing the beautiful harmonious strains of a composition by a race woman, performed by an aggregation of master musicians of the white race, under the German conductor Frederick Stock, who had personally championed the piece. The symphony was a faultless work, Chicago Daily News reported, worthy of a place in the regular symphonic repertory. Old prejudices die hard, however, and Price's first symphony fell into obscurity in the decades following her death in 1953. The Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements have, though, recently prompted a timely reappraisal of Price's place in American music history. Recent recordings of the First Symphony, conductor Yannick Nezet-Seguin's with the Philadelphia Orchestra in particular, have underlined its warmly Dvorakian palette and the rich peppering of African-American melodic influences. We are waking up to the fact, pregnant with possibilities, that we already have a folk music in the Negro spirituals, Price once wrote. It is simple heart music, and therefore powerful. In the June 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising star pianist Yoav Levonen. Where were you born? Tel Aviv, Israel. What is your career highlight so far? Performing Chopin's first piano concerto at the Teatro di San Gallo in Naples when I was 11, my first solo recital at the Verbier Festival, and signing with Harrison Barrow Management. I'm also really excited to release my first album, A Monument to Beethoven, this year with Warner Classics. Who are your musical heroes? I'm honored to be working with two of them, pianists Murray Pariah and Andras Schiff. Their dedication to exploring and attention to detail is inspiring. What would be your dream concert? A concert signaling the end of the COVID pandemic, streamed worldwide and uniting millions of people in celebration. In the July 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Terry Blaine describes the near suicide of Beethoven's nephew Karl. On the 29th of July, 1826, a young man climbed up to the hillside ruins of Castle Rauenstein in Baden, a spa town 20 miles south of Vienna. Arriving at his destination, he drew two pistols from his pocket. Aiming one at his head, he pulled the trigger, but the bullet either missed or misfired in the chamber. The second pistol, however, partially found its target. The bullet gouged the left-hand side of the shooter's skull without entering the brain, leaving him slumped and barely conscious. Who was the unfortunate individual? It soon emerged his name was Karl von Beethoven, nephew of the famed composer Ludwig, and that his attempted suicide was anything but a spur-of-the-moment decision. Just days earlier, Karl's landlord, Schlemmer, had warned Beethoven that the 19-year-old intended to shoot himself next Sunday at the latest. Schlemmer found two pistols in Karl's room, but Karl had pawned his watch to buy replacements. What pushed him to such a desperate situation? Karl himself had no doubt what had caused it. His uncle Ludwig had tormented him too much, he told police investigating the incident. I became worse because my uncle wanted me to be better. Posterity has tended to agree with the unfortunate Karl's analysis. Beethoven's fraught involvement with his nephew began 11 years earlier when the composer's younger brother Caspar died, leaving behind his wife Johanna and 9-year-old Karl. Caspar's will originally made both Johanna and Beethoven Karl's guardians. But Johanna's name was subsequently deleted, seemingly at Beethoven's insistence. I did not wish to be bound up with such a bad woman in a matter of such importance as the education of the child," he wrote. What exactly was bad about Johanna? Her conviction for embezzlement in 1811, after purloining a set of pearls that she was selling on consignment, was one notorious mark against her. Johanna was also, Beethoven believed, an adulteress, perhaps a prostitute who had killed her husband by poisoning. Kaspar actually died from consumption. Morally outraged, he vowed to wrest a poor, unhappy child from the clutches of a vicious, bestial mother. Beethoven's jaundiced view of Johanna was unquestionably exaggerated. "An obsession bordering on the insane," one commentator has called it. She herself lived in a toxic relationship with an abusive husband who allegedly once pinned her hand with a knife to the dinner table. Kaspar also beat his son, and likely Johanna too. Beethoven knew about the turmoil and wanted to remove Karl from any further possibility of domestic upset. Instead, he achieved exactly the opposite. 5 years of legal wrangling for the custody of his nephew followed, which only traumatized Karl further. Beethoven repeatedly tried to stop the boy seeing his mother and exerted an iron control over his education. Unsurprisingly, Karl reacted badly, fleeing Beethoven's home, stealing money, and at one point even striking his uncle. By July 1826, Beethoven's stifling protectiveness had pushed Karl to breaking point. His attempted suicide at Castle Rauenstein was, however, a turning point of sorts. On recovery, he joined the army, married, and fathered 5 children. When Beethoven died in 1827, he left everything to Karl, making him financially comfortable for the future. In truth, Beethoven had never stopped loving the nephew he called my son. He dreamed of shaping a young man to be proud of, one to fill the void of loneliness that Beethoven's own failure to build lasting emotional relationships had created. But as one Beethoven biographer has put it, he never realized that a child cannot be shaped like a piece of music. In the June 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising male soprano star Samuel Marinho. Where were you born? Caracas, Venezuela. What would be your career highlight? My first appearance in Handel's Berenice at the Halle Handel Festival, the applause was huge. After I did an improvised high note, people started screaming and clapping before I'd even finished the aria. Just thinking about it still gives me goosebumps. Who would be your musical hero? Maria Callas wanted to show a different way of singing opera. Just as she did, I want to be open to the audience and give a multidimensional experience of listening to music. What would be your dream concert? A multicultural concert uniting different art forms and cultures from different communities. In the July 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, Charlotte Smith interviews violinist Gidon Kremer. Gidon Kremer hasn't always been an advocate for Mieczysław Weinberg. Despite dedicating much of his time and energy to performing and recording the Polish composer's work in recent years, the celebrated Latvian violinist wasn't entirely convinced of Weinberg's genius initially. I recognized the power and weight of his music much too late, he admits ruefully. I attended some of his performances and was presented with the possibility of speaking to him while I was studying in Moscow, but I didn't use that opportunity, as at the time I was more interested in exploring the avant-garde. Weinberg's music seemed to me too classic, too Soviet. It was with a very different attitude that Kramer celebrated his 75th birthday earlier this year, however, with a new album of Weinberg's sonatas for solo violin on ECM, recorded live in 2013 and in studio sessions in 2019. And he enthusiastically explains that his Weinberg phase is far from over. I am still full of Weinberg, in the same way that 10 or 15 years ago I was full of Piazzolla, and before that, Schnittke and Goodbye Dulina. He was, remains, and will always be one of the major composers of the 20th century. He is often considered a secondary composer to Shostakovich, and the two were very close, often comparing scores. But each of them has their own distinct musical signature, and Weinberg's music is incredibly personal. Certainly, a defining characteristic of the composer is the incredible technical difficulty of his works. Written in 1964, 67, and 79, the three solo violin sonatas feature a range of dissonant double stops played at full throttle by Kramer, in addition to dramatic leaps, lean, wispy textures, and delicate harmonics. To take on such repertoire is not, perhaps, the natural choice of a musician in his 70s, but Kramer has always considered it his duty to support the creativity of our time. Despite a career that began in the most traditional of ways, studies with David Oistrakh at the Moscow Conservatory, followed by back-to-back competition wins at the 1969 Paganini and 1970 Tchaikovsky, Kramer's dedication to modern and contemporary composers has taken him on paths less traveled. A weighty proportion of his staggering 120-odd albums on Deutsche Grammophon, Philips, EMI, Decca, ECM, and Nonesuch are dedicated to names such as Schnittke, Pert, Goodbye Dulina, Silvestrov, Nono, Vasks, Adams, and Glass. Equally, new music lies at the heart of his eponymous Kramerata Baltica Chamber Orchestra, founded in 1997, and Lokenhaus Festival, which he directed for 30 years before handing the reins to cellist Nikolaus Alstedt in 2011. In Weinberg, though, he has found an especially meaningful connection, as the Jewish composer's flight from war and persecution in Poland during the Second World War mirrors that of Kramer's own father. Weinberg's is a very sad voice, he says, but it's this that attracts me to his music. You can feel the tragedy that he lived through, and it's the same tragedy that my father suffered when 35 of his relatives, including his first wife and daughter, were murdered in a ghetto in Riga. Weinberg fled to the USSR from Warsaw and lost many of his relatives, too. Given their personal correlation, it's little wonder that Kramer takes great pleasure in promoting the composer's numerous symphonic, chamber, operatic, and vocal works. He goes so far as to compare the violin sonatas favorably, not only with Bartok's Sonata for Solo Violin, but with Bach's sonatas and partitas, Himalayas of violin music, though they are, I'm not afraid to make such a comparison, as the Weinberg sonatas are monuments of fantastic, compact writing. Despite their technical complexity, I wouldn't miss a bar of them, as they are multidimensional musical statements. So it was logical for me to learn them, though I admit it was a challenge at my age. It's not the only time the subject of age comes up during our interview. Of little surprise, of course, considering the 75-year milestone that Kramer reached in February. But the violinist seems as busy and curious as ever. In addition to his continuing Weinberg fixation, he's keen to return to explorations of Mozart. The violin sonatas, given that he has recorded the concertos twice, and Beethoven's late string quartets and piano trios. He is at pains to stress, though, that this doesn't mean I will forget about serving contemporary composers, particularly with his Cremerata Baltica. Directing the orchestra means he can surround himself with so many open-minded young players, which is the best gift I could give to myself when I was 50, and I'm still enjoying it now that I'm 75. It's a source of some pride, in fact, that now the orchestra has been running for 25 years, only 4 of the original members have remained with the group. So it remains an orchestra where the average age of players is around 30. Which lessons does he hope to impart to the young musicians? I have always tried to share the importance of advancing and expanding the repertoire, he says. I want to pass on my dreams, my tastes, and my knowledge to the next generation. And I am happy to say that today's Cremerata is still full of freshness. For the group's latest project, Eine andere Winterreise, he has asked a number of contemporary composers to orchestrate songs from Schubert's famous cycle for the ensemble, and he hopes to perform these at festivals throughout the summer. It's a typically innovative project from a musician who does have some concerns about the music industry in the 21st century. The industry these days is often more interested in quantity than quality, he begins carefully. And surface is sometimes considered more important than the underlying message. There are many wonderfully talented young musicians, but some, in their haste to achieve success, apply a copy-and-paste method to their interpretations rather than thinking deeply about the works for themselves. They are tempted by dazzling large audiences rather than serving the music itself. I think as interpreters we are obliged to serve the music, regardless of how successful this approach may be. This does not, however, diminish his admiration for the many young players who work so hard to say something personal in their interpretations and to develop an individual signature. And he's eager to point out that there are plenty of good musicians nowadays, just as there were when I was a young violinist. I have always shared the value of advancing and expanding the musical repertoire. Certainly many of these young musicians have been found at Kramer's Lockenhaus Festival at one time or another in the 41 years since the Austrian Chamber event was established as a home with open doors in 1981. The sheer variety of performers and composers associated with the festival is apparent on ECM's Edition Lockenhaus box set, which was reissued in March this year in celebration of Kramer's birthday, and features illustrious names such as Katia Bunyatishvili, Gerard Cosset, Thomas Domingue, David Geringas, Heinz Holliger, Kim Kashkazian, Thomas Zietmeyer, Tabea Zimmermann, and Simon Rattle. Fundamentally different from more conventional classical festivals, Lockenhaus quickly became a gathering point for young musicians eager to pool their energies, skills, and knowledge, and the box set is particularly interesting considering the opportunity it allows to hear some of the world's finest chamber music players relatively early in their careers. I have learned so much from the partnerships established with the hundreds of great musicians who visited, says Kramer. And I don't want to sound like I'm name-dropping, he caveats with a self-deprecating laugh, but most of my friends and colleagues who visited the festival were and are great artists. It's typical of Kramer's humble attitude to his artistry that the composer's voice remains at the heart of his artistic mission. And as our interview draws to a close, he expresses a new desire to seek out Ukrainian composers in response to the country's bombardment by Russian forces. What's happening in the world at present is so appalling. So I want to support the Ukrainian people with my violin and musicianship. At least a little bit, he says. We must support the country's musicians, artists, and culture. And in my small way, I'd like to do that by promoting Ukrainian music. If his success in promoting the works of Weinberg is anything to go by, we should all expect to be introduced to some of the country's leading contemporary voices in the coming months and years. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.